Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Article 1, Section 14 of the Missouri Constitution grants all Missourians a right against the enactment of any arbitrary or unreasonable barrier to their access to the courts to bring a recognized cause of action to redress a recognized injury. In the Kilmer and Cardinal Glennon cases, this Court held that a barrier that subjects a recognized injury to the discretion of a nonjudicial third party is arbitrary and unreasonable and violates this constitutional right. Now, Section 538.225 of the revised statutes, which is the Medical Injury Affidavit of Merit statute, is exactly such an invalid barrier. First, it carves out a subclass from all personal injury plaintiffs of those seeking damages against a healthcare provider due to the rendering or failure to render healthcare services. Then, it requires that within 90 days of filing their petition, these plaintiffs, like no other plaintiffs, must obtain and necessarily pay for a qualified written expert opinion that their case has merit and must file an affidavit disclosing the expert's identity. If they don't do this, the statute requires, at least since 2005 has required, that the trial court dismiss the case with no discretion otherwise. In so doing, Section 538.225 subjects a recognized injury to the absolute discretion of a nonjudicial third party. Just like the statute struck down in Kilmer and Cardinal Glennon, this violates Article 1, Section 14.
Should we also strike down the cases that require you to have an expert in order to make a submissible case then in medical negligence cases?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
But that leaves it to the discretion of a third party in the same way, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't, Your Honor. That becomes the discretion of the trial court. There are certain types of cases that, as we discussed in our
brief. Well, the trial court has no discretion to make a medical negligence case submissible if it involves a complex injury, does it?
Well, it certainly, but that's the trial court doing so. That's not a nonjudicial third party. This is, by the time that would come up, say in the directed verdict or a summary judgment or something like that, the parties are already in court. There is no access to the courts that's been violated in that circumstance. And
there was a point where you had to get approval of a board before you could file suit, and that statute was invalidated, I believe. And this statute was enacted that required you to act within 90 days after you file suit. How does that affect your access to the court's argument?
Well, because what we're talking about is meaningful access to the courts. For example, the case to which you're referring, Judge, is Cardinal Glennon. In the Kilmer case, which also struck down the statute that preconditioned someone's ability to come into court on a third party, was this prosecutor for a dram shop action.
Well, that's because the prosecutor had absolute discretion not to file it.
Sir.
Here, the party controls whether or not they can get an affidavit or not. In other words, you have the authority is within the party to see if they can find an expert to bring a submissible case.
Well, that's
different than somebody totally unrelated to the party. In other words, if the prosecutor is my brother-in-law and he doesn't want me to file a case, he just doesn't exercise his authority.
Sure.
There's nothing I can do about that. That's different than giving me the ability. I can't shop outside my county to find a prosecutor to file a charge, but I can dutifully look the world over for an expert who has an opinion to justify my case.
I mean,
that assumes no time before the day you have to file it to look for an affidavit.
But that's always a possibility, and I think
here we know that isn't the barrier because there were affidavits filed in case number one and affidavits filed in case number three. So we know that isn't the scenario that you're facing.
And I'm not arguing that it is. But I think the interesting thing about the prosecutor example, Your Honor, is as Judge Smith was just asking, we're talking about, you know, filing something in a court. In the dram shop, under that invalid dram shop statute, a party ostensibly could file a petition, and they could go to their local county courthouse and file the petition, just as they could without a medical affidavit of merit here. But the court would be, on any party's motion, bound to dismiss it under that statute that was struck down in Kilmer. It's really the same thing. You're talking about someone physically coming into court who, under some statute, the statute says, well, you can't meaningfully be here.
And
who's the third party that has the discretion here to decide whether or not you can file?
The medical expert. If no medical expert within this prescribed time period.
But isn't that totally different than a gatekeeper prosecutor? I mean, the medical expert is whether or not you can find evidence to support your case, versus a prosecutor exercising discretion whether or not to file.
But whether you can, well, as the defendants admit in their briefs, the pretrial litigation in a medical negligence case takes far longer than 90 days, as this court knows well. It's certainly possible that at the outset a party doesn't have that expert, but will produce them at trial. And
so it's a matter of timing and how much time you get to make your case, and that's an access issue?
No, that's not the access issue.
Well,
the access.
And what about Judge Fisher's point that this might be an interesting argument from somebody who couldn't get an affidavit, but you did. You had affidavits. You just didn't file.
Your Honor, the point is we shouldn't have had to file them in the first place. That later, and I think it's interesting that the statute before 2005, by making this discretionary, as the Mahoney case kind of harps on a trial judge, is in this exact circumstance where my party did have an expert who didn't complete the technicality of filing the affidavit. Before 2005, under this same statute, I think it's apparent from Judge McKenzie's order, he wouldn't have dismissed this. Because it would have been apparent that, well, you know, guess what? We actually do have an expert. Sorry, we simply didn't file the affidavit.
And regarding that, can you address your substantial compliance argument?
Certainly, Your Honor. We substantially complied with the intent of the statute. And it's interesting, in Judge McKenzie's order, he notes very specifically, and the defendants don't contradict this in their briefs, that they never argued that they were prejudiced by our failure to file an affidavit. It's readily apparent by their absolute agreement, as the trial court found in its order, to transfer the discovery from case number one to case number two.
And does the fact that there was a deposition, I assume a sworn deposition, mm-hmm. Is that sort of an affidavit plus, so it substantially complies? Is that your argument?
No, the point is that in Mahoney, this court goes into great detail about discussing what the intent of that statute is. The intent is to create a procedure to dismiss medical negligence lawsuits that lack even color of merit to protect the public and litigants from the cost of ungrounded medical malpractice claims. This is not such a claim. This claim obviously meets that threshold, meets that bar, and the defendants knew it. The point to the sworn deposition that the defendants themselves attended is they knew very well that this wasn't such a case.
And it wasn't until over a year after the second suit was filed before they complained. Is that
exactly.
correct?
Exactly.
So are you saying you got kind of sandbagged, or it's invited error? Or?
I'm not necessarily saying. Well, colloquially, Your Honor, I would call it sandbagging. Yes.
Well, we know that we enforce agreements that are in writing or on the record, and we always do that. Where in the record is the best place for us to see what this agreement was that puts the case in the best light for you?
To transfer the discovery,
not the transfer of the discovery. That the transfer of the discovery also included an agreement to satisfy the statutory obligation.
Oh, okay. A couple of things. That would be attached to the it's a series of emails, letters attached to the response in opposition to the defendant's motion to dismiss in case number two. Also, I think it bears note that Judge McKenzie, in his judgment dismissing the case, notes that there was such an agreement. That is a finding of fact, and the defendants do not cross-appeal, so they are bound by anything that's against them under the Goldberg versus State Tax Commission case from 1981, which isn't cited, but I happen to know that case. So that's the best place to find it. The defendants don't deny that they knew of this, that they attended the deposition, so therefore we certainly didn't substantially comply with the intent of the statute. This is not.
Should our analysis be affected by the fact that the statute says that if defendants feel an affidavit is inadequate, they can then ask for a deposition within 6 months and sort out whether there's a sufficient opinion for the case to go forward? And here you had a deposition in that first case, which then was transferred over to this case.
No, I hadn't thought about that angle, Your Honor, but I think that actually makes sense, too, that yes, since it does provide that if they think this is inadequate, there can be a deposition, they've never suggested that this expert's opinion was inadequate. What they're only harping on, the only thing that they're talking about is our failure to complete this technicality of filing a piece of paper in court.
Do you contend that the agreement included an agreement either that the prior affidavits would be deemed filed in the new case, or that you would be relieved of that obligation?
We certainly do contend that it would be deemed filed, yes, that the agreement did encompass that.
What if you had a case where the first suit, you had the affidavit on time, mm-hmm. You dismissed it without prejudice, you filed the second suit, there was no agreement, there had been no deposition taken, no agreement about any discovery that had been taken to that point, and no affidavit was filed with the second suit. Different case, do you lose?
Well, as to the constitutional arguments, no, we don't lose. Those would still remain the same because the point there is that no one has to file these. As to the substantial compliance argument, the question would then become, as in the other cases that have raised substantial compliance in Missouri, were the defendants put on notice of the expert's identity and his opinion? If in that example, Your Honor, that was true, then no, I don't think we would lose in that circumstance either. The question is, if we fit the intent of the statute, if we've met its terms substantially, as in all the other substantial compliance cases, we cite dozens of them in our brief.
Does the testimony in the deposition address all the issues that are required to be addressed by an affidavit?
Yes, Your Honor, it certainly does. The deposition explains in detail, it's by an eminent physician at Johns Hopkins, specializing in exactly what the doctor who was alleged to have caused the injury specialized in internal medicine. He explained it was his professional opinion that all three defendants breached their standard of care by not ordering home health care for the decedent, instructing the decedent to perform his own wet to dry dressing changes, providing him with incomplete written instructions, providing him with inadequate oral instructions when he was still under the effects of anesthesia. And he explained that these breaches caused the decedent to develop the infection that ultimately resulted in his death. It's quite detailed. I mean, it's a very long deposition. I invite the court to read it. It's in actually both of the legal files from cases 2 and 3. And that's what makes this more unfortunate. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have some time on rebuttal.
May it please the court?
Yes.
I'm going to speak or attempt to speak for about 7 minutes and then I'll pass to co-counsel. There are a couple of issues that plaintiff touched upon that I want to address first as it relates to what actually happened, the actual agreement and the record on that issue. It's obviously an important part of this case, although frankly, since they didn't preserve anything, we don't think you ever reached that. But I want to be sure that we're clear on what the agreement actually was. First off, there's no indication in any of the record that there was an agreement that the affidavit be transferred. The agreement was, it was an informal agreement between counsel. I was one of those attorneys who was part of this agreement, and the agreement was we will transfer the discovery that's happened to date, namely depositions, the deposition of Dr. Burke.
Did it say discovery or say depositions?
Discovery.
So what affidavits are often, I mean, is it sort of, could it be interpreted, and maybe yes, maybe no, as a statutorily required discovery, you have to provide an affidavit, but that's something you would normally do in discovery prior to the statute?
I don't believe so, because the Missouri Rules Civil Procedure 56 that actually defines the discovery methods does not include the affidavit, does not include that statutory affidavit. It's a different, it's really a different animal, because the affidavit itself is notice to the court, and plaintiffs have painted that as a notice to opposing party, that we know there's an expert.
But is its purpose, I mean, traditionally you would try to discover the opinions of experts identified by the other side, and the legislature has said, in order to make sure that we don't spend all this time and energy and effort and money pursuing a case which is not going to be submissible, you need to put down those affidavits up front.
But yes, that's true, and it actually brings me to the next point, which is that the deposition in this case is actually inadequate. It doesn't satisfy all
okay.
the elements of the
Can
affidavit.
Can you address that for me?
Yes, and it's actually page 56 and 57 of Dr. Burke's deposition. It's the only time in the deposition he talks about causation at all. He describes kind of the mechanism, that there was an emboli that resulted in a stroke, vegetation on the heart or a portion of the heart, but he never talks about the fact that any actions taken by either the defendants in wet to dry dressings caused that injury, caused that death. He never reaches that conclusion. In addition, there are other portions of the affidavit you know, qualifications, information, all the identifying information in terms of the expert. If we're just talking technically, was it all in the deposition? It wasn't there. But the bigger issue is it wasn't, the court was never on notice of it. No affidavit was ever filed. And so the court didn't, I mean, they didn't meet the statute itself, which is a mandatory statute.
And what is the purpose of filing the affidavit? To give the court notice?
The purpose, yeah, to give the court notice and to ensure that at the time that affidavit has been filed, that there's somebody who can meet all those requirements.
Well, and is there any question that your client knew that because this was dismissed and refiled?
Well,
the same judge, is that correct? Or a different judge?
Different judge. Okay. So the court certainly wasn't aware of it. What we were aware of at that point was that Dr. Berg, I mean, we fully intended at some point to file something because Dr. Berg hadn't met the requirements for plaintiffs to continue with their cause of action.
Does the statute kind of
intend? We hadn't been obligated to do that yet. I'm sorry.
And this, if Mr. Stitt would answer this, either whoever's appropriate, but the statute does put a 6-month limit on being able to take a deposition if you think an affidavit is inadequate. Is that an indication that the legislature intended an issue with the affidavit to be brought up early in the case, as opposed to here it was more than a year later?
I don't think necessarily, because I think the best indication that the legislature intended to put a time limit on it would have been to put a time limit on our ability to file a motion to dismiss. There's no time limit on that. And it certainly wasn't a matter of sandbagging in this case. I mean, the parties had a discussion about this discovery, which everyone knew involved the deposition, certainly not an affidavit. The best evidence of that, we're talking about evidence in the record, and it's in the transcript, I believe. I'll have to look at the page number, but plaintiff's counsel actually acknowledges on the record in the motion for reconsideration that he'd received a phone call from counsel for St. Luke's Hospital notifying him, hey, look, this affidavit wasn't filed. That's because we never had an agreement that the affidavits from the first case would transfer to the second. So we certainly, you know, try to put everyone on notice of this. If I can, if I've answered those questions, I may move quickly to the issue of...
Was this issue about the agreement just raised in the motion to reconsider, not in response to the motion to dismiss?
I believe that's true. I need to double check. I believe that's true. And perhaps co-counsel can double check that, because I certainly want to fully disclose what we knew, but I believe that's correct. Moving to just the issue of preservation itself, I think we have an interesting argument here. We've made it clear it's an issue of first impression in Missouri, but the plaintiffs really had two options available to them when this case was dismissed for failure to file an affidavit. They could have appealed that immediately. It's clear from the Mahoney case that would have been a final judgment, an appealable judgment, or they could file case number 3, I guess. They took the unusual step of doing both. And so at the time the notice of appeal for case number 2 was filed, they actually had case number 3 on file and were pursuing, you know, same parties, same alleged negligence. And so it would suggest logically that there was no full and final judgment that would be appropriate for appeal in case number 2 if we have a case number 3 currently pending. We raised that because we think that's obviously an important consideration for the court. In addition,
have you filed a motion to dismiss in case number 3?
We did file a motion to dismiss. It was dismissed, and that's actually on appeal here today too. So we've got case number 2 and case number 3. Mm-hmm. It's kind of piecemeal litigation. The reason,
but doesn't,
but that, on that basis,
on
yes.
that basis, doesn't that change your argument that they had the option and did it?
I think the only reason it changes the argument is because that was the ultimate outcome, and it's just convenient that we're all here today hearing them both at the same time, but it doesn't change the purpose, which is in order to appeal a case and spend the time and the judicial resources, you need to know that's a final judgment. You're not going to continue to proceed in any other way, shape, or form.
Well, Mahoney says that it's appealable even though it's without prejudice.
Yes.
And without prejudice means it can be filed again.
Yes.
So why doesn't Mahoney defeat your argument?
Well, I guess simply because it's an issue of first impression, it hasn't totally been addressed. I mean, I think we still think that that is a viable argument. It's certainly why we brought it up, but it's not the only one, because the constitutional issues, if we go to case number 2 and simply address that, the constitutional issues in case number 2 clearly weren't preserved. They weren't brought up for the first time until oral argument on the motion for reconsideration. There was no pleading on that issue whatsoever. So I, with that, if I have answered everyone's questions, we'll pass the mic. Thank you.
Good
I think that's the first time I've seen anyone actually sit down when they said they would. That's very impressive.
Your Honor, may it please the Court. I'm Hank Stitt, and I represent the other respondents in this case. There are two reasons why it's unnecessary to reach the merits of the constitutional challenge in this case. Those are that the plaintiffs lack standing to assert an as-applied challenge to the statute, together with they have an inability to make a valid facial challenge. And the second one is that they fail to timely present their challenge to the trial court so as to preserve it for review. Now, the plaintiffs' lack of standing to make an as-applied challenge results from the fact that they were not harmed by the particular feature of the statute that they assert is either arbitrary or unreasonably burdensome. That particular feature is the requirement that Med-Mal plaintiffs obtain a medical opinion regarding negligence and causation and do so within the first 3 months. The plaintiff's complaint about that particular requirement is twofold. One, that it imposes an unreasonably high expense on medical malpractice plaintiffs, that being the cost of obtaining that opinion. And two, that it's arbitrary in the sense of over-inclusive, because it would require a medical opinion even from those Med-Mal plaintiffs whose cases don't need medical testimony in order to be submissible. These plaintiffs cannot claim any adverse consequences from this medical opinion requirement in either of these two respects. They can't complain that they had to incur an unreasonably high expense in order to maintain case number two because they'd already incurred the expense, whatever that might have been, in obtaining a medical opinion in case number one. And they didn't challenge having to incur that expense in case number one. They simply voluntarily dismissed it. They did not seek appeal. They couldn't have sought a review of that. Plaintiffs also can't complain that the requirement has operated over-inclusively as to them by requiring a medical opinion in a case that would not have needed medical opinion testimony to be submissible. That's because the record doesn't support the conclusion that this particular case is one of those that would be submissible without expert opinion testimony. Now, the record is fairly slim on this, but that's a little telling as well. But to begin with, the petition that the plaintiffs filed in case number two doesn't suggest that it's one of those types of obvious negligence cases, the kind of thing where a physician leaves an instrument in the body during surgery. Anybody can understand that that's negligence. Also, plaintiffs never made any attempt to make any record to suggest that their case was one of those types of cases that doesn't require medical expert testimony. And of course, the defendants never really had an opportunity to try to make a record demonstrating that it was one of those types of cases requiring medical expert testimony, because this doesn't even come up until after the judgment in the context of a post-trial motion, and frankly, fairly perfunctorily raised in that context.
Counsel, can you jump to the presentation and preservation part with regard to the facial challenge? I hate to cut you off, but I think
presentation preservation with regard to facial challenge.
Well, you were talking about not having standing for an as-applied challenge, and the other argument.
Sure. Yeah. Well, the facial challenge part of it is, and I don't think of it as standing as such. It's simply neither they nor anyone else has the capacity to make a facial challenge, because in order to do that, anyone would have to demonstrate that under every conceivable set of circumstances, the application of the statute would impose an unconstitutional burden on each of those conceivable set of circumstances. Neither these plaintiffs nor anyone else can make such a showing, because there are conceivable circumstances under which the statute would clearly not result in an unconstitutional imposition. And ironically enough, we know that because those circumstances are these. Neither these plaintiffs nor anyone of their ilk, other plaintiffs who have filed a Med-Mal action, gotten a medical opinion, and then voluntarily dismissed that action, no one in that category can demonstrate that this particular statutory requirement operates unconstitutionally as to them. As a consequence, a facial challenge to the statute is not available.
Mr. Stitt, I know you're focusing on the Constitution, but I'd like you to look at the words of the statute. And it requires the affidavit be filed with the court saying that plaintiff has obtained the written opinion of a legally qualified health care provider, which states that the defendant health care provider failed to use the care a reasonably prudent health care provider would use under similar circumstances and that directly caused or contributed to cause the injuries. Why doesn't a sworn deposition fill that requirement?
Well, first of all, that requirement is that requirement. It is as stated in the statute, an affidavit from a qualified medical care provider.
Why isn't it substantial compliance where, I mean, what is the difference between an affidavit and deposition if, in the sense that it's
well,
a statement under oath,
right.
They're different, but why isn't a deposition just more than an affidavit, not less?
Well, the short answer is that it's not an affidavit. Deposition is not an affidavit. The somewhat longer answer is it sort of begs the question of what's the purpose behind
exactly.
The legislature
yes.
imposing this requirement. And I've heard some discussion about that. I think that the real purpose here is to ensure to some extent that frivolous cases are either not filed or at least don't hang on the docket very long. And it is a very preliminary kind of thing. An affidavit, distinct from a deposition, if for no other reason than it is somewhat extremely more perfunctory. It is a threshold requirement, and it has a built-in timing element that goes along with it. This case, frankly, is very similar to the Froggy versus Nyquist case from back in, I think, 1970 that's mentioned on 49 and 50 of my brief. There, it was a municipal notice statute, and the complaint by the and it wasn't done correctly. The complaint by the plaintiff there was, well, I gave it to the city clerk. Well, the statute says you must give it to the mayor, as I recall. And there wasn't any complaint, and the plaintiff is also claiming, but it gave the right kind of notice, and it was made within the right period of time. They knew about it. This court said, well, the statute means what the statute says. And that requirement of in the statute of giving it in writing to the mayor was separate and apart from any sort of notice component, any sort of purpose of the statute to make sure that the city had notice. There's also a by God tag requirement. And that tag requirement was not met, and therefore the statute wasn't satisfied. And of course, as my brief demonstrates, there is really no substantial compliance principle in Missouri in any event. And to the extent that there's anything close, it has to do with construction of ambiguous procedural statutes. And this is in no way an ambiguous procedural statute. There are no words implicated here that are at all of any doubtful meaning. Thank you.
No further questions. Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Sternberg, does the record reflect that defense counsel called plaintiff's counsel within the first 90 days of the second case being filed and telling them that they didn't file their affidavits?
No, Your Honor. It does not. I'm not aware of anything in the record that says that. It's actually, contrary to the representations you just heard, it is a fairly voluminous record. It's 200 some odd page legal files. But I'm pretty sure that no, I don't have any record of that. A couple of things, though, about the record. It was initially suggested that the argument about the agreement was not raised in response to the defense's motion to dismiss in case number 2. That's not true. Pages 88 to 90 of the legal file in that case have exactly that argument.
Was it in response to the motion to dismiss or the motion to reconsider?
It was in response to the motion to dismiss. It is in there, absolutely. Pages 88 to 90 of legal file, I'm calling it volume 1. It's in the first case, SC93012. The constitutional issues absolutely were raised in the pleadings. Opposing counsel says they were not. In every single copy of every single petition that is in front of this court, it's stated expressly that Section 538.225 violates both the right to a jury trial and the open court's provisions, and it cites those provisions by article and section. It's also re-raised in the motion to reconsider. That's all this court has ever required, is to put the trial court and the other side on notice of the claim and give the trial court an opportunity to decide it. That was done.
Explain, I know everybody files a motion to reconsider, but what's the closest thing, or at least that when somebody loses they do, what's the closest thing or motion rule that a motion to reconsider really is? Is it a motion for new trial?
It's either a motion to amend or a motion for a new trial. It's one or the other. There are a couple cases from this court from the 90s talking about that. It's Taylor versus UPS, it's 854 Southwest 2nd 390, and Massaman Construction versus Missouri Highway and Transportation Commission, 914 Southwest 2nd 801. Both talk that, there's no such thing as a motion to reconsider. I'm well aware of that.
Well, we know motions for new trial don't preserve constitutional error. Do motions to amend judgments preserve constitutional error?
Motions for new trials will preserve them if they're previously raised, certainly. This was raised earlier. This was raised in the petition itself, which all the cases about that say is the earliest time to raise the unconstitutionality of the statute. It was then, you have to raise it and preserve it, kind of like in a jury trial. It was preserved in the motion, in the post-judgment motion, whatever we want to call it. The plaintiffs certainly were harmed. Their case was dismissed. As for conceivable circumstances, I think there are conceivable circumstances where someone wouldn't have been harmed in Kilmer if the prosecutor had filed a prosecution against someone for a dram shop violation. See, I'm out of time, though. If the court has any further questions, I'll ask the court to reverse.
Thank you, counsel. This matter will be taken under advisement.